It's good to be back with you. Did you miss us a little bit? We kind of left you in reasonably good hands with this young fella across the parking lot over there. What's his name? Mr. Ted, yeah. So we are now going to launch in for real. Big picture, as you know, we're exploring the story of Martin Luther because the story of Martin Luther is the keystone to a bigger story. And that is the story of the Reformation. So we're going to be looking at the events. We're going to be looking at the radical new theology, and it was. Luther created theology that had never existed in the church's history. It was revolutionary in the truest sense of the word. And it gives rise to the Protestant faith, out of which we are a part of. Now, we're not Lutherans, but we are part of the heritage that he kind of created. Our tradition comes out of England and the Church of England, but we hold many of the core beliefs he had central to ours as well. We began by starting out with spending 2 weeks on a topic that is guaranteed to put you to sleep, okay? If you ever have insomnia, rule one, read Leviticus. That'll do it, yeah. If everybody's going, I'm going to read the Bible cover to cover, Leviticus. You know, they're just gone, okay? Or medieval spirituality, okay? Because that is a very foreign landscape to us. But that is the spiritual world of Martin Luther. It is the spiritual world in the backdrop to the Reformation. We're going to be talking next week about the 95 Theses. The 95 Theses are in dialogue with that spiritual world. It was a world obsessed with how do you get rid of the guilt of sin. Those of us raised in the Baptist Church are not the only ones that struggled with that, okay? Of how to get right with God, how to enter heaven. Okay, this was the big burning issue of the Middle Ages. If you've ever seen medieval art, very graphic depictions of hell, very graphic depictions of heaven. You know where you want to go, you know where you do not want to go. Any Baptist in the room knows this, okay. This is the world that lays behind the 95 Theses. These are the issues that drove the Reformation. It's a world in which heaven and hell were very, very real. There was a belief in something called purgatory, which is if you're not bad enough to go to hell or good enough to go to heaven, you went to a way station, okay? And this is a belief that had been around for many, many, everybody in the Middle Ages believed this, okay? And so where does most of humanity wind up? You wind up in purgatory, okay? This is the realm of the saints, this is the realm of relics, and of course, merit, and then of course, it's the realm of indulgences. So Luther is going to tie in the theses to a topic that is the tip of an iceberg that's a much bigger picture.
Does anybody today still believe in purgatory?
Yes. The Catholic Church still has in their catechism belief in purgatory, and they still sell indulgences. Okay? I mean, I did not believe that, but yeah. I went ahead and I read the catechism recently. Right. Yeah, all of this stuff that we're talking about is medieval Christianity. Right. Then the Council of Trent sanctions as official Catholic doctrine. Now, the more extreme abuses have been done away with. Mm-hmm. But indulgences still exist.
And purgatory.
Purgatory still exists. It's official Catholic. And the unofficial one is called limbo, which is where one unbaptized infants go. So it's an elaborate scheme. Again, those of us in our tradition, this is foreign real estate to us, okay? Ted Campbell then gave us a broad picture of Luther and his thought. Did he do a good job? Oh, yeah, yeah. This is why we want to keep him in our good graces and keep getting him back over here, yeah. But he had 3 weeks to do something that we're now going to recover, and we're going to go through the middle of January, okay? We're going to go through, there's a lot of books that are out. A lot of good information, so we're going to go through this methodically. Today we're going to begin the in-depth exploration, having had the medieval world, spiritual world as a backdrop, having Ted sort of just lay out the landscape. Now we're going to go through it in great detail. Luther's story and the birth of the Reformation. The truth of the matter is we're going to cover 5 years between the end of 1517 and 1523. That is when the world turned upside down. Now, Luther will live for another 20-plus years. But by 1523, at a place called Worms, you ever heard of that? Yeah, and then translating the Bible into German. By that time, it's a done deal. Okay, it's a done deal. The ramifications have to work out. We're going to draw heavily on the Renew's research. Two books came. while I was on the trip, so now I've got to plow through those and see if they are going to add anything else. If you look at Luther's life, and the biographers are sort of universal in this, there's nothing in his early life that would have prepared you for what was going to happen. He's just a typical medieval person, medieval monk, and later a medieval priest. He's born in 1483. Does that date ring a bell? Or approximately? What else is going on then? 1492? Okay. During this time, the Moor, the Ottoman Empire, the Muslims, are at the gates of Vienna, having swept the Eastern Empire off the map, coming forward, and the Spanish king has taken and driven the Moors out of Spain. And so a lot of things are going on at this time. He's born, not Luther, but Luther, to Hans and Margaret Luther. He actually changes his name to Luther later. Y'all remember Lori Luther? Yeah. You're here? Okay, that's from that tradition. His father is a leaseholder of copper mines and smelters, and he may have actually owned some of them. So he is no peasant, he is not royalty. He has what eventually will become the middle class. But at this point, the middle class doesn't formally exist. But we're beginning to get that. The medieval world, even before Luther, is starting to come unravel. The Black Death, population decreases, things like that. So his father runs many mines. He runs smelters. He may have owned some of them. 1501, Luther enters the University of Erfurt. Big name I'm sure you've heard of all the time, but it's a college town. At the age of 19. 1505, he gets his master's degree, he enters law school. It is his father's dream that Martin would become a lawyer. Luther seems destined to fulfill his father's wish because if you're in the emerging business community, is it a good thing to have a lawyer in the family? Okay, it is a very good thing. So he's in the world of contracts, negotiating things, and so his dream is that Martin would become a lawyer. He would join the family enterprise, maybe taking it over from his father, from Hans. And so he had a lot of wishes there. There are a series of very unlikely events that take this trajectory and send Martin in an entirely new direction. There's several of them. The first one happens on July the 2nd, 1505. Luther has gone home for a break to visit his family. He's now returning back to the law school. There is a tremendous thunderstorm, and a bolt of lightning strikes very near him. And he is terrified. He's afraid he'll die. As a matter of fact, he thinks he will die. And if you die in the Middle Ages, what do you have to face? Yeah, and if you've, all those images you've seen, Michelangelo and all that, this is the medieval kind of world. You know, contemplating your death could be a very frightening thing, as it was for him. He cries out, a typical medieval prayer, St. Anne, protect me, I will become a monk. So who the heck is St. Anne? Anybody know? The Virgin Mary's mother. Okay. In the medieval world, if you want to get to God, who do you go through to get to God? The Son. But if you don't feel like you get to the Son real quick, who do you go to? For any Jewish boy, who do you go to? His mother, okay. And if you can't get to her, who do you go to? Yeah, Anne. So you'll see Catholic churches around here. Now, what's interesting, it's not surprising that he takes this vow. A lot of people in stressful situations make vows they have no intention of completing. What is ironic is that he fulfills it. His entire life is said this way. 19 days later, Martin enters an Augustinian monastery in the town of Erfurt where he lives, where he's been a student. Just drops everything and enters the monastery. He joins a group called the Observant Augustinians. This is a recent development in the Augustinian order. They are known for a lot of things. One of the things they're known for is they are friars. Now, what's a friar? A friar is a monk who's not a monk. A friar is a monk who does not live in the monastery, but they live in the world, and they serve. And we still have orders that do that. So one of the ways you could serve in the world was to be a teacher at a university. So he does not stay in the monastery praying. He actually gets involved in the world. The observant Augustinians are known for their scholarship, like the Jesuits are, and they're known for producing excellent teachers at universities. They provide the teachers for the University at Erfurt, where he's a student. Interestingly, they're also providing the professors at this brand new upstart university down the road at a little place, armpit of the world, called Wittenberg. Wittenberg is like No Trees, Texas, okay? It's just nobody knows about it. Nobody knows anything about it. It's about to become the most famous place in Europe. But when Luther goes there, it is not. It's brand new. The monastery also happens to have the best library available, which gives to Luther excellent background to do reading. He's going to be doing work in Scripture. He's also going to be studying. Now, if he's an Augustinian monk, who do you think he should study? Yeah, St. Augustine. And St. Augustine is going to be the key that begins to shift his theology. Luther spends the next 20 years as an Augustinian monk. Okay? We think of him as the reformer. He spends 20 years as an Augustinian monk, including the early years of the Reformation. He only ceases to be a monk at some point when his supervisor actually releases him from his vows, but that's further down the road. Now, like many in the Middle Ages, and I'm going to say with Luther probably more than most, he is burdened with this sense of unworthiness and guilt about his sins. I don't think it's an overstatement to say he may be just a little bit OCD about this, okay? You'll understand why in a minute, you know. He feels great unworthiness before a righteous and holy God, but he's a medieval person. And in the medieval world, there's a way that you can take care of this. And so he knows what's the best thing you can do? Become a monk. Become a priest. Devote your whole life to God, which is what he's done. He seeks to remove the guilt by being righteous, defined not as we define righteousness, but defined by the Middle Ages, the way they define righteousness. In the Middle Ages, you do things. You go to Mass. You venerate the saints. You take pilgrimages. You do things. It's very much like the Jewish faith. He does everything a medieval Christian is supposed to do. He devotes long hours to fasting, prayer, pilgrimage, confession. His confession ritual is interesting. He's known for spending up to 6 hours in confession. Now realize that in the Catholic Church at this time, somebody has to sit there and listen to you confess. Who is the unlucky person that gets him today? And then Luther would return because he forgot something. Okay. And literally, this is true, he wore his confessors out. Okay. Just, you know, blah, blah, just too much. He fasted so much, he almost died. I'm more looking. This is a guy who is a person of faith. He's operating out of the medieval model, but he's an intense person of faith. He's the poster child of medieval spirituality. He is doing absolutely everything that you should do to feel forgiven and to feel accepted by God. I mean, there's not a box he doesn't check going down it. He probably checks it 2 or 3 times. Everything he can possibly do, yet it gives him no comfort. Now, this sets in place a dynamic. If you're doing everything you've been taught to do, but it does not give you satisfaction, does that put some interesting things in play? Yeah, maybe some questions are beginning to roll there, okay? No matter what he did, he never felt like he was worthy of God's forgiveness. He's very, very clear about this. It's this quest to get right with God that is eventually going to lead Luther through reading Augustine and through reading Romans and Paul's letters to his great theological breakthrough, which becomes the foundation of the Protestant Reformation. But it's this struggle. You know, how can I be acceptable to God? What is it I have to do to be acceptable to God? 1507, he's ordained into the priesthood. So he's now not only a monk and a friar, he's also a priest. And by the way, the Augustinian monks are the pastors of the churches in the area. So now he's going to actually pastor a church, which sets another dynamic going. His friend and supervisor, von Staupitz, sent him to the new University of Wittenberg. This is in 1508. He's there for a year as a guest lecturer. What it sounds like is von Staupitz is sending him there to kind of check him out to see if maybe he could become the new Bible professor at this new university. Because von Staupitz is actually going to exit from that. 1510, Luther and one other monk are sent to Rome as representatives of his order. Okay, this is a high privilege. There's a dispute in the Augustinian order as to how much should you be observant. There are those who kind of like play loose with the rules, kind of lax, and that's the main Augustinian group at this point. But there's a movement within the Augustinian movement, which is von Staupitz is one of them, who believes that you should actually tighten the rules down and become sort of hyper-religious. Does it make sense which one Luther goes with? Okay, he goes with that. While there, Luther would have a second of his defining experiences. When he first saw Rome, he fell to the ground and shouted out, typical medieval mindset, "Holy Rome, I salute you." I mean, he is in awe of this place. Rome is the capital of the Christian faith. It is the center of Christian spirituality. Well, in Jerusalem? Well, somebody's occupying Jerusalem. Who might that be? The Ottomans. Okay, they've taken that over. Okay. With the Holy Land cut off by the Ottoman Turks, Rome is now the ultimate site for Christians for a pilgrimage. This is where you can go. It's the ultimate place. And his order has sent him there. He wants to see as many religious signs. There's seven famous churches there that go back to the early church, and he wants to do them all. There's enough there. You could spend a lot of time there. And he enters into a typical Lutheran fashion. He just goes after it. As many places as he can go to. These are going to provide him with opportunities to gain indulgences. Remember, this is the tip of the spiritual iceberg. Every place that you go, everything that you do, you can earn God's grace through indulgences by doing this. This is not buying. This is earning it by your actions, by what you do. Later, in his commentary on Psalm 117, he reflects back, and this is the observation he makes. "Oh, how I regret that my father and mother are still alive." That's sick. But it's not. "What pleasure I should have in delivering them from the fires of purgatory by my masses, my prayers, and so many other admirable works." This is the medieval mindset. To this point, is Luther a reformer? He's no reformer. He's a medieval person thinking, I'm in Rome. It's like, you know, the land of plenty. Yeah, the land of plenty for all of this. And he can make advantage of it. But in Rome, Luther also encounters something else that he finds deeply disturbing and may, for the first time, put some doubts into his head. He arrives at the height of the debauchery of the Renaissance papacy. We've talked about that before. The Medici popes, the Borgia popes, you know, who were notorious. Even Catholic scholars refer to these guys as the monsters, okay? They were not religious people. They had armies. They waged wars. They did all kinds of things, okay? Luther's bothered by the luxurious living, the greed, the blatant immorality that he finds not in the people, but in the clergy. Cardinals, bishops, priests. This immorality is accompanied by a mockery of spiritual things, and Luther kind of zeroes on this because he finds this really hard to deal with. He finds people, priests, saying masses as fast as they could. He says they could say four to his one. Okay, that's how fast they're talking. Now, why would you do that? Well, why would you want to say as many masses as possible? Well, you're paid for saying masses. So what's the incentive? Economics, yeah. If I get paid for each mass I said, and I say it as fast as I can, I have more revenue coming in. So the idea is they want to maximize their income, which Luther finds to be not a particularly spiritual motivation, okay? You know, and that's the tip of the iceberg. He finds priests joking with each other that since masses are said in Latin, and since the people do not understand Latin, we can have some fun, okay? We can say things like, "Bread you are and bread you shall remain." And all the people are going, yeah, you know, they have no idea what's going on, okay? They're poking fun at the ignorance of people. They're also poking fun at the Mass, the center of Christian worship. Priests would even twist the central statement in the Mass, the words that make the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. Instead of saying in Latin, "This is my body," which is hoc est corpus meum, they say hocus pocus, which is the origin of the term. It's a nonsense term. It's just, you know, just they're just having fun with it kind of thing. Luther would later reflect in his works, he says this, "I was a thoughtful and pious young monk. What I saw and heard grieved me bitterly." Can you hear it? Okay. He goes to ground zero of the Christian faith, and what he finds there appalls him. It's in Rome that Luther learned that the institution of the church and the Christian faith may not necessarily be the same. Later, Luther will redefine the church not as an institution, but as a body of believers who are committed to Christ. Okay? Those seeds may be planted all the way back here. Institution does not equal. So later, in defense of the church, Luther will stand against the institution. And you can see how some of this may go back to this point. He finishes his doctorate. He returns to Wittenberg to be a professor of Bible. He's going to spend the rest of his life in Wittenberg. Now, he travels some, and he does spend about 10 months in Marburg Castle, where he translates the New Testament into German. But this is basically his home for the rest of his life. Wittenberg is the stage on which the Reformation will play out. Yeah, there's other places, Worms, Augsburg, Heidelberg, Leipzig, these events will happen. But basically, if you want to know where ground zero of the Reformation is, it's Wittenberg. And that is the place that the Catholic Church at one point would love to have gotten rid of. Once he arrives in Wittenberg, he's going to spend 6 quiet years as a professor. We have his lecture notes. They survive. He lectures on Psalms. He lectures on Romans. He lectures on Galatians, he lectures on Hebrews, okay? And his notes are very extensive, and we can actually go through it. And one of the things that scholars say in looking at these is that for about most of the time, about 90% of the time, what strikes you is that there's nothing reformish about it. This is a medieval monk operating within the thought world of medieval Christianity, and he's not questioning anything. Now, he's also reading Augustine. And it's in his notes in Augustine that we begin to get a little bit of shift there. This is from 1511 to 1517. Does the end of that date make sense to you? Okay, this is leading up. During this time, he advances in the hierarchy of the university. 1512, he becomes the director of theological studies at the university. He's head of the department. Okay, so he's advancing up. He also becomes a leader in the Augustinian order. By 1515, 4 years after Rome, 2 years before his theses, he's overseeing 11 monasteries. So he's not just he may be relatively unknown outside this area, but he's not a nobody. This is a guy that's advancing in the university setting. It's advancing in the Augustine order, and he is generally acknowledged to be one of the comers, okay? People know he's sharp, he's talented, he's a comer. And so he's being kind of fast-tracked through this. Now, something else that stood out in Wittenberg, besides this brand new university, which was a big deal, is that it's a collection of relics. Some of you may know this story, but it's an interesting story because it's the backdrop. Wittenberg, if you lived in the early 1500s anywhere in Europe, you would know. The one thing you would know about Wittenberg, you would know about its university. The one thing you would know about Wittenberg is that it had an outstanding collection of relics. A vast collection. We talked about this a few weeks back, but relics are physical remains of holy people, holy items, holy places. And the idea is if you touch them, you touch holiness, you touch God. Because they were remains of something holy, they themselves carry that. Now, that's not a tradition that most of us as Protestants are familiar with, but that is the medieval world. The idea is that relics carry great spiritual power. You want to be near them. You want to touch them. You want to be in their presence. All Saints Church in Wittenberg, this is the church that he nails the 95 Theses to, is renowned for having one of the largest collections of relics in all of Western Christendom. This little jerkwater town in the middle of nowhere. That's because Frederick, the prince of that area, is really into this. All Saints Church had 9 aisles displaying over 20,000 relics. They're in storage, and they come out twice a year. You know, one of the times they come out is November 1st, All Saints. And the day before is when he posts the theses. The ruler of the Erech, Frederick the Wise, is the guy. If you ask, why did Luther get away with this when other people got killed? One of the reasons is he's got Frederick the Wise as his prince who supports him, in spite of the fact that Frederick the Wise probably embodies everything that Luther's against. Okay, he is into relics, he's into the whole medieval spirituality. But Luther is his scholar from his university. Frederick had a catalog made. By the way, catalogs still exist. These are actual pictures of the catalog. He has a catalog made of the relics of the church with woodblock print images. This is one of the first things that actually has pictures of what he's doing. Okay, so what do we got? Well, he boasts a collection among 20,000. I'm not going to hit you with all 20,000, okay? This is the highlights. We have a wisp of straw from Christ's crib. That's good. We have one of Christ's diapers. I'm not thinking that's quite as good, okay? Some of the gold and myrrh offered by the wise men. By the way, these are all lifted directly from the directory, okay? A strand of Christ's beard. It gets better, okay? It gets better, okay? Pieces of Christ's clothing. A piece of bread from the Last Supper. Slightly dry, okay? The cloth from the washing of the feet. A nail of the true cross. You remember how important the true cross was? When you're fighting the Saracens and you're going to battle, what do you want to have in front of you? The true cross. We also have wood from the true cross. Somebody once commented that there's enough scraps of the true cross to make more than one cross. But part of the crown of thorns placed on Christ's head. Items with Christ's blood on them. A few of Mary's hairs. Bits of Mary's clothing. Yarn that she spun. Did you know Mary spun? Apparently she was very good. Okay. Vials of milk from Mary's breast. I'm sorry, that's just... In the book. It's in the book, okay? The body of one of the children slain by Herod at Bethlehem. Medieval spirituality is not for the faint of heart, okay? A twig from the burning bush, slightly singed, okay? A piece of Aaron's rod, a piece of Moses' staff, dirt, rocks, and stones from every location of every event in the ministry of Jesus in his life, okay? Just one aisle, go down. Bits and pieces of every town, room, and piece of furniture that Mary had ever touched, okay? Countless bones and artifacts from multiple saints who had died somewhere along the way. That is the spiritual world of Martin Luther. And when he writes the 95 Theses, he does not question one of these things. He assumes all of it as part of his world. This is the world of the 95 Theses. When Luther's going to begin to dialogue with this world in the Theses, and we'll spend the next 3 weeks kind of going over those and kind of the big picture of that. And it's the backdrop against which the Reformation is played out. All of this stuff is what the Reformation is about. Now, today we get a chuckle out of this, but in the late Middle Ages, this was not laughing material. Okay, this was the heart of their faith. They took it with utterly seriousness. Here's why. The veneration of each of the 20,000 relics, and by the way, your goal was to touch them all. Your goal was you wanted to get all of them for a very good reason we're going to look at. You want to walk by them, you want to touch them, and you want to say a prayer. Times 20,000. Why would you do that? Well, doing that results in an indulgence, time off from purgatory. Pilgrims pass down the aisles, they venerate the relics. Each object gives them 100 days off of purgatory. You turn the corner on the aisle, you get a 101-day bonus for turning the aisle.
Is this just in their mind? Or does
it's in the catalog.
Somebody
calculated it. This is actually in the catalog.
But who knows what you touched?
I guess it's the honor system,
okay,
I think.
That's
okay.
What I
would you cut corners? You in purgatory, just like this. Okay, yeah, okay, okay. According to the catalog, if you do the entire 20,000, you cut 2 million days off of purgatory. Is that worth it? Okay. No surprise. This is Saint, by the way, this is from this one church alone. The one church alone. Early 16th century, Wittenberg is one of the greatest pilgrimage sites in Europe. Can you see why? I don't know about you, but if I'm thinking I'm going to purgatory, I want the max shaved off that. And so this would not be a bad way to spend a few days, okay? But for the medieval Christian, there's yet another way to reduce time in purgatory for yourself or for those you love. Another way you could get indulgences, you could buy them. This is a recent development, by the way. Very recent development. 1517, there's that magic year again, right? Leo X, one of the Medici popes, began to offer indulgences for those who gave money to rebuild St. Peter's in Rome. Originally, indulgences were given for those who volunteered to go fight the Muslims in the Holy Land. Then it was given to those who may not go, but they would financially support it. And from there, it's just a small leap to other monetary causes that you would do. So in 1517, this pope decides, by the way, you been to St. Peter's? Seen pictures? That's the church that indulgence is built. And have you seen that place? There's a special running now on TV, on the High Definition channel about that. It's just amazing, I think. That didn't come cheap. And the money had to come from somewhere, okay? He issues what's called the St. Peter's Indulgence. And the St. Peter's Indulgence is a really good one, you want it, okay? Because it has the thing. You talk about 2 million days. How would you like a plenary indulgence? Wipe it all out. Get out of jail free card. Okay? That's a plenary indulgence. Okay? He also sells franchises to others who can sell indulgences. This is a good business model, by the way. This is a good business model. How many can you sell in Rome? Well, if I give an archbishop in Germany permission to sell and some of the income would flow back to me, by the way, here was the business model. 50% you sent to Rome, 50% you kept. I'm not making this up, okay? This is actually true. In Germany, there's a guy called Cardinal Albrecht of Brandenburg and Mainz, and you know, you're not allowed to be archbishop of more than one place, and he manages to pull off three. He's archbishop of one, he controls the second, and he buys permission to take a third, okay? He's one of the ones who bought the right to sell indulgences. Well, why? It cost a lot to buy rights to be archbishop of more than one place. For one, it's against the law, so not only do you have to buy it, you have to buy a special dispensation from the Pope, so you can do that. And, you know, it's very expensive. Cardinal Albrecht has a particularly aggressive in selling indulgences for a very good reason. He is up to here in debt to a family, the Fodors, who loaned him this money. And if he does not pay the debt, he could face financial disaster. So we have a very, very strong motivation. We want to. Here's the other thing. Indulgences have been selling rapidly earlier, but by this time, 1517, there's indulgence burnout, and they're not selling. So if the market is collapsing and the need is great, we need a new business model. You want to be a little bit more aggressive, okay? He advertised that his indulgences allowed escape from all the pains of purgatory. They are plenary indulgences. By the way, the Pope gave him permission to do that. It's Albrecht who hired this guy, Johann Tetzel. Now, Protestants love to poke fun at Johann Tetzel, and he's some kind of a buffoon. That's how Luther would describe him. He's not. He's one of the most highly educated people in Europe. He's a great scholar. He is in charge of the Inquisition, which was going to play a role a little bit later. And he is a master salesperson. So Albrecht hires the right guy. For Tetzel, there are no limits to what you can say if you want to. By the way, Tetzel gets to keep some of it too. That's the way it's a pyramid scheme. Back to the Pope. This is something that Albrecht encouraged. Albrecht actually prints a little writing called the Instructions. These are the instructions for how you sell the indulgences. Luther gets a hold of a copy. Whoa. Like, you know, that gets Luther going. We'll talk about that 2 weeks from now. But the instructions make it very clear that all of the stuff that Tetzel does that breaks every rule we've ever had has been authorized by the archbishop. And the authorization goes back to Rome. Tetzel claimed that you could actually purchase forgiveness of sin not just remission of the satisfactions. Remember, three things. You had to be honestly repentant. You had to confess to a priest. Those got you forgiveness. But then you had to do satisfactions to make right with God. Indulgences are limited to satisfactions. Tetzel starts to sell them. No. It's good for the whole thing. You know, you don't have to repent. You don't have to confess. You don't have to do these other things. His famous jingle, you've heard, as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. Tetzel swears he never said this. Luther said, too many eyewitnesses, okay? Too many eyewitnesses heard you say that. That's not, there's the best one. He goes so far as to claim his indulgences are so effective, if you raped the Virgin Mary, you would be full pardon. Tesla said, I did not say that. Numerous witnesses said, oh, yes, you did, you know. Which means, is that, that's a good sales pitch, right? Now, if you can get off from this, what else can you get off from? There's even an understanding here that maybe you can get an indulgence for crimes yet to be committed. Okay. So a lot of things are going on here. Okay. Tesla does not ask people if they are repentant. He does not ask them if they confess to a priest, both of which are required. You know, if you're going to get the sacrament of penance, get forgiveness. For Albrecht, for Tetzel, it's simply a financial transaction. This is the way Luther hears it. I don't think Luther missed the point either. Yeah. Give me money, we give you God's grace. Forgiveness for cash. You could buy your way or your loved one's way out of purgatory, and if you get out of purgatory, where do you go? Straight to heaven. Okay. We got a theology professor at Wittenberg who's not real sure this is good theology, okay? Beginning of Springs 1517, look at the map. Do you see Jüterbog? Do you see Wittenberg? What you don't see is there's a line that goes between the two. In the southern part where Wittenberg is the prince, is Frederick, Luther's prince. Luther's prince forbids the selling of indulgences in his area. But the problem is that just up the road, you're in another prince's area. He allows it to be sold. So at Jüterbog, just up the road, Tetzel arrives, and he starts selling indulgences, spring of 1517. Now, members of Luther's church start showing up. Remember, he's pastor of a church. Members of his church start showing up with their indulgences and saying, we don't need to do penance. This is what triggers Luther. Luther's first concern is pastoral. His people, he says, are being defrauded. His people are being told something that is not true. His people are being told you can buy God's grace. Luther knows that is not true. So this seems to be the motivation kind of behind. We know that in 1517, before October 31st, on at least six occasions, Luther preaches a sermon against indulgences from the pulpit of his church. His supervisor Staupitz also does the same thing. So this practice of selling indulgences is a brand new thing. It is highly controversial. A lot of people are upset about it. Luther's hammering it. Several sermons. November 1st, All Saints Day, the relics are about to be wheeled out the next day. They're going to be on public display. The doors of the church are going to open. Thousands are going to pour into the church. They're going to receive indulgences, venerating the relics inside. And the day before, on the eve, the day before the relics are shown, the day before indulgences are to be earned, Luther nails 95 discussion topics on the door of the church, clearly having Tetzel and Albrecht mind, because some of the things I told you that Tetzel said are in the 95 theses. Okay, so he knows what's going on. So next week, we're going to pick up with the theses, sort of lay the big picture, look at what's going on there, and also look at something else Luther did. Luther also the same day writes a letter. Actually, he sends the 95 theses to Albrecht, the guy selling them, with a cover letter that nobody ever reads. You think the 95 theses are topical. Okay, so we'll do that. So that's where we're headed. So I hope that you will enjoy the journey. It is not going to be a boring ride, okay?